Well, on behalf of Silverstone, I'm pleased to welcome you here to this session, which I think is going to be most interesting. A couple of housekeeping rules. This is a cell phone. This is a cell phone turned off. If you don't know how to do that, figure that out soon, okay? That's what I tell my students. I remember many, many years ago when I first met Paul Edwards, thinking what a short span of history it was to be sitting with the great-grandson of Joseph Smith. It brought it all kind of together. And the span of history of Mormonism that includes those who came west and those who didn't is most interesting, and I think we're going to hear some interesting aspects of part of that story today from Lachlan Mackay, who is the director of the Community of Christ Historic Sites and currently resides in Nauvoo, Illinois. There should be plenty of time for questions afterwards, and we'll ask you to come up and come to the microphone simply because this session, along with all the others, is being recorded. So see how you do in your recording today, and if you don't do well, come back another session or tomorrow and re-record and see if you like it any better. And so without any further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to Lachlan. He's going to make his presentation, and then he's going to field questions. One last bit of housekeeping that I'm sure my friend Kurt Bench and others would be glad I would say. Please visit the book room and spend lots and lots and lots of money if you can. So with that, commercial endorsement. Lachlan, the floor is yours.
So I've spent about 15, 16, 17, 18 years at Community of Christ Historic Sites. And I spend a lot of time talking about dates and names. And it's getting kind of boring, not just for me, but for my visitors, I think. So we are starting to think more and more about stories and trying to come up with ways to put stories into our interpretation at the sites, as well as do more storytelling in our churches. And so I'm going to just tell you some stories today about Joseph Smith III, and some of them will be simply to introduce you to Joseph III or his family, but others will be on topics that are important to Community Christ today, and stories that kind of inform, we think, how we've ended up where we're at and where we're going. Now, our historical community is still debating how much of the stories you're going to hear have caused us to be who we are today, versus how much of the stories you're going to hear are us looking at our history through new eyes. And I'm sure it's both. But I'm just going to tell some stories. Most of you are familiar, I think, with the story of the Nauvoo Legion. It only makes sense, as I think the story of Nauvoo only makes sense, if you remember what happened to the Latter-day Saints in northern Missouri. They're involved in a civil war there that ends with the extermination order, as Alex Boss pointed out, which didn't mean leave or we'll kill you. It meant leave or we'll forcibly remove you. But whatever it meant, there were soon people killed on both sides, and the Latter-day Saints were deeply scarred by that experience. They get to Nauvoo, and they are not going to let that happen again. And they start doing things to protect themselves. The Legion, a great expression of that. But imagine if you're not a Latter-day Saint, and you show up in Nauvoo on a Saturday, as Stephen Douglas did, a good friend of the Smiths and of the church. He saw thousands of Latter-day Saints marching and under uniform, and at times there were cannons in the prophet's yard. And so if you hadn't lived through Missouri, it would be really difficult to make sense of what you were witnessing in Nauvoo on a Legion parade day. As was common in the early 19th century, military titles became really important to us. And so we often talk about Joseph Smith's Red Brick Store today, but if you go back and look for that term in the early history, it shows up very little. It's more often General Smith's Store, or at times Joseph's Store. And Joseph Jr. on one occasion was listening to a visiting minister. The guy was saying, you know, I was in church on Sunday and talking to my parishioners, and I said, that Joe Smith. Joseph interrupted him and said, sir, considering only the time and the place, don't you think General Joseph Smith would be more appropriate? These military titles are becoming really important to us. Now, that wasn't just us, but that was for Joseph III. that became a bit of an issue. Now, he's a child as that's happening, and so much of what I'm going to share with you are reminiscences. They would be colored by his later experiences as well. But here's what Joseph III had to say about the Nauvoo Legion and about his father. You know, he's very careful in how he says this. There's about a page where he's saying, I don't mean to criticize, but here's what he says. I have no desire or object after the lapse of years to sit in judgment or pass censure upon these men, though I may concede that I believe it was a mistake to allow the spirit of militarism to take possession of the leading authorities of the church. He's including his father in that statement. That, I think, is pretty significant. Joseph III also tells a story about a man named Austin Cowles, kind of a minor leader in the Nauvoo Church, who, after Joseph's death, chose not to support the Council of the Twelve. And Austin was uncomfortable with plural marriage. Nauvoo became a very rough place after Joseph Jr.'s death. Not that there weren't rough spots before. But once the Nauvoo City Charter is pulled by the Illinois State Legislature, the city had no way to police themselves anymore. They were no longer a city. They were just a bunch of people living in one spot. And so they had to come up with creative ways to police themselves. Some of them got a little out of control. And one of those was what's called the Whistling and Whittling Brigade. We've kind of mythologized it as a bunch of little boys with pen knives and sticks. There probably were some little boys in the crowd, but they also had young adults with very large knives and spears. And so Austin Cowles came to town one day and quickly was surrounded by 30-plus people. And they spent the day following him very closely, whistling and whittling with the knives, flashing all around this poor old guy. This guy was a believing Latter-day Saint. He was just uncomfortable with plural marriage and was not particularly supportive of the Council of the Twelve at that point. Joseph III saw what was happening to this old guy, and he went out, and he's a child, he's maybe 14, 13. He went out and he tried to get him to stop, which for a child, I mean, that takes a lot of courage. They didn't, and that just kind of egged him on. And he said, the last I saw of Austin Cowles, this group was escorting him out of town to the ferry. Here's what Joseph III said about that experience. The intolerance of bigotry, long complained of by the church as exhibited towards the elders preaching abroad, found lodgment in the city and raged with rabid venom against the apostate and recalcitrant. All those who dared to express an opinion not in strict accord with the rulers were ostracized. May God soon send the day when the curse of intolerance may be known no more in the land. As some of the church leaders prepared to head west, they wanted to give a young Joseph Smith III gifts to remember them by. And Brigham Young gave Joseph III a beautiful little pistol. And Joseph III's cousin, George A. Smith, gave him a very large Bowie knife. Is it Bowie or Bowie? Bowie? Depends on what part of the country you're in, I think. Big knife that he thought Emma would enjoy in the kitchen. Apparently, Bowie knives are not kitchen knives, so he traded it for a large cherry rolling pin that one of the Huntington boys had made, and he gave the rolling pin to his mother. Bishop N.K. Whitney, who worked out of the Kirtland store at times, I'm sorry, owned a store in Kirtland and worked out of the Nauvoo Red Brick store, knew of these other gifts, the gun and the knife. He called Joseph Smith III in and said, young Joseph, I want to help you understand that the pen is mightier than the sword. I'm going to give you my writing desk. And he did, and you see it in the Red Brick store today. Joseph III later gave it to his brother David, who passed it to his son Albert, who passed it to his son Lynn, came back to us from Lynn and Lorraine Smith. The pen is mightier than the sword. Here's something else Joseph III had to say about that experience. I seemed to feel at the time that his, Whitney's, intention was to foster within me a spirit of peace rather than one of conflict. At all events, these were the effects they produced upon me, for I did not imbibe the spirit of war and had little use for its dangerous weapons. Just a couple of fun stories to introduce you to Louis Biedemann, Joseph Smith III's stepfather. You see Louis bottom left in this photo, Joseph III bottom right. Louis was not particularly a religious man and seemed to love to say that he believed in one God who had neither partner nor clerks. One of my favorite Louis stories, might feel differently if this had happened to me, Louis was courting Emma, and Emma and Joseph III were in an upstairs window, and I'm not sure if they were in the homestead of the mansion house at this point in time, but Joseph III tells the story. He's up in the window with his mother. Louis comes calling. And Louis was a very dapper man, he, kind of a fancy dresser. He sees Emma in the window. He takes off his top hat, and he does a very formal, deep, stiff bow. On the way back up, he runs into a clothesline and knocks off his toupee. One of our later historians commented that throughout their life together, this is not historically accurate, but true, he said that throughout their married life together, Emma was known as the Widow Smith, and her husband was known, I'm sorry, Louis was known as the husband of the Widow Smith. Not necessarily historically accurate, but Louis, I think, reveled in being the husband of the widow of the prophet. Louis and Emma set up Joseph III in storekeeping in the Red Brick Store after Joseph Jr.'s death. He was probably about 15 at the time. He was sleeping in the Red Brick Store one night when he was woken suddenly, saw a brilliant light coming from the window. It sounds like the start of a wonderful experience. Unfortunately, it was not. It was the Nauvoo Temple burning on the hill. So he was sleeping in the store, guarding his store stock the night that the temple was burned. Joseph III says, and I think this is some insight into his personality, that he was a terrible storekeeper. Now, for one thing, most of the potential customers are heading across the plains, but the bigger issue is that he refused to bargain with people. Whatever the price was the price. And he thought he would be cheating somebody if he gave one person a deal and not everybody. He simply could not bring himself to bargain. Here's how he described it. Concerning the stock of goods at the store and its manager, which was him, it was soon discovered that the latter had no faculty for selling. I suppose the prices marked were the ones at which the goods should really be sold. I used no sliding scale of prices. I asked no more than they were marked, but would sell for no less. He soon went out of business. As Joseph grew, he ended up meeting and marrying Emmeline Griswold. Joseph III was widowed twice, married three times, had 17 children. His first and true love, Emmeline Griswold. He describes their wedding day. The minister who performed the marriage, as soon as he finished with the ceremony, stepped in to kiss the bride. Before Joseph III had his description. Reverend Waldemeyer used to delight in relating how I forestalled him when he leaned forward to kiss the bride after pronouncing the ceremony. Quickly intervening, I remarked, "After me, if you please." That kiss, which I placed upon the lips of my bride upon this occasion, was the second I had ever given her, the first being given at her mother's gate as the seal of our troth on the evening she consented to become my wife. By 1860, most of Nauvoo's population were immigrants. All but 40 families were German, with some Swiss and some French mixed in. Admire that photo, though. That's circa 1885, probably from the second floor of the Temple House, a commercial building up across the street from the Nauvoo Temple. And I described to visitors Nauvoo's 1840s 1,200 log cabins and 300 to 500 timber frame homes and 200 to 300 brick homes. but they're all gone. Most are gone. So it's really hard to imagine Nauvoo as a city. This captures Nauvoo as a city, circa 1885. Most of those buildings are about to go. They've probably had little maintenance since the 1840s. But because it had snowed, it outlines the roofs of the buildings. Nauvoo as a city, and that's the flats, the south part of the peninsula that you're looking at. So Joseph III is elected Justice of the Peace in Nauvoo in 1857. He starts serving in 1858. And in that role, he began to come into contact with lots of these immigrants, lots and lots of immigrants, of course. And he fairly quickly decided that they were often being taken advantage of by others in the community. And here's his response to that. Of the immigrants, I drew their deeds, their mortgages, their contracts, and when they were brought before me in civil suits, I managed in many instances to secure settlement out of court, whereby they were saved much trouble and expense. For all these services, I had freely lowered the costs and fees when any were too poor to pay or could ill afford to, and in many cases made no charge at all. It did not suit me to see industrious citizens oppressed because of their lack of familiarity with our language and customs. Because of Stephen Douglas's friendship with the Smiths, Joseph III, as a young man, was a big fan of Douglas, a strong supporter of Douglas. And he went to Carthage, Illinois, one day. It was probably the 1858 Senate campaign. But he went to Carthage to listen to Stephen Douglas speak. And they had a bowery set up, so a stage with branches up above to form some shade. And Douglas got up to speak, and he apparently was drunk. He was slurring. He couldn't get a coherent sentence out. And Joseph III was deeply, deeply disappointed. He kind of idolized this guy because he had been so helpful to his father in the early years. Deeply disappointed. He went back a week later to listen to his opponent speak. The guy stood up, and he was so tall that he wouldn't fit under the bowery. So he's all kind of hunched up, trying to talk, and just was a ridiculous-looking figure. Finally, the guy took his hat off, stuck his head up through the branches of the bowery. Then all you had was a head floating up above. Everybody started laughing. They pulled the branches down. The guy stood up to his full height, put his top hat on, started speaking, and within a paragraph or two, Joseph Smith III was converted by Abraham Lincoln. Here's what he had to say about it. In a few moments, his oratory and argument held us spellbound. I forgot the man, forgot that aching sense of pity or shame that had burned in my bosom for him. And by the time the lecture was over, I was completely and altogether a Lincoln man, with a political conscience more firmly fixed than ever in its opposition to slavery and its evils. As Justice of the Peace, Joseph III was charged with helping to apprehend runaway slaves. You can probably imagine how this is going to go. Not well. He refused to do so. And in one occasion, a Mr. Yates threatened him with the law if he didn't enforce the law as Justice of the Peace. Here's Joseph III's response. The United States courts and the courts of this state combined could not make laws fast enough or binding enough to make a slave catcher out of me. Joseph III, by about 1856, was starting to struggle with what to do with his life. He had some friends in Nauvoo who were encouraging him to come to Utah. And they had, on business, traveled through Utah on a number of occasions, and they were saying things like, well, you can go out there and take over. I'm sure they'll follow you, and you can break up that polygamy thing. Or, if it suits you, you could become a church leader and take three or four wives and live happily ever after. And Joseph III actually, apparently, started to think about it. Well, maybe polygamy is of God. Maybe this is just my own prejudices. Maybe I should go out there. But eventually had an experience that led him to believe that that was not the path that he should take. About a month later, several LDS apostles came through and met with him. He shared with them that he was not going to be coming out. And then not long after that, several reorganized missionaries came to Nauvoo. He stopped just short of kicking them out of his house on their first visit. One of them ended up sticking around for almost a year and helping out on the farm and just kind of building a relationship with Joseph III. Eventually, he felt led to unite with the reorganization. This is just a brief excerpt of what he said on the day that he did that, April 6th of 1830. "I came here not of myself, but by the influence of the Spirit. I have come in obedience to a power not my own, and shall be dictated by the power that sent me. I believe in the doctrine of honesty and truth. The Bible contains such doctrines, and so do the Book of Mormon and the Book of Covenants, which are auxiliaries to the Bible." Robin, I thought that was really interesting, that Community of Christ 2003 statement on the scriptures seems not far different than what he's saying in 1860. "If the same Spirit which prompts my coming prompts also my reception, I am with you." Now, this I think is critically important, is the part about the scriptures. Joseph III really defined who we were by turning to the Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants. And if he couldn't find what he thought was strong support for a teaching in those sources, it usually didn't become part of us. And he says on several occasions, you know, I don't care what people are saying about my father and plural marriage or polygamy. The standard books of the church don't support it, and that's where I'm turning. When Joseph III first joined with the reorganization in 1860, he was toying with the idea of gathered community. His stepfather, Louis Weideman, wasn't particularly supportive of the church, but was supportive of the idea of speculating on a new community, a new gathered community. So he apparently went to Independence and then on up to Florence, Nebraska, winter quarters, and is searching for a new home for the new reorganization. And it sounds like he even made verbal commitments in Florence, which Joseph III and Emma were horrified of when they found out what he'd done. But Joseph III was also considering Nauvoo as a place to gather. And there was soon misunderstanding about that. And fairly soon, there were meetings all over Hancock County. Each township was getting together and putting together resolutions forbidding Joseph III, in some cases, to preach or pray or sing Mormonism in Hancock County. There was pretty strong opposition early on. He was deeply hurt by that. You know, here he's an elected official in the place. I think folks really couldn't complain about his role in the community, but here they are, including the mayor of Nauvoo, delivering usually unsigned petitions, or not petitions, resolutions, denouncing what he's doing. He was deeply offended. He said of that experience, "This feeling of prejudice against me because of my religion aroused my indignation. I was a pioneer of the county. No citizen could truthfully charge me with criminal conduct of any kind. And yet to think that one so prominent as the mayor should oppose me and hold me up to public scorn, and that too in articles to which he had not the decency to sign his own name." He was ticked. As a new church leader, Joseph III attended a recruiting meeting for the Civil War in Nauvoo. And the recruiter was doing a sad, sad job. He was not able to sign anyone up. And Nauvoo had had to come up with, they had quotas, something like 17 people. They had to come up with these recruits. And so somebody in the meeting said, "Well, there's young Joe Smith, he's a minister. Let's have him speak. Maybe he can do better." And initially he said, no. But he said, as they were chanting his name, I was overcome by the patriotic spirit. And he went up and he started delivering a rousing recruiting speech. And by the time he was done, something like 17 people had signed up. He was recruiting for the Union Army. And then he went home and he thought about what he had done. And he was horrified. Wait a minute, I'm a minister of the gospel. And I'm recruiting people to fight in this war. But that led him to step back and said, you know, what should the position of the church be on matters related to war? And he engaged his followers in that discussion and through prayer and debate. And here is what he came up with eventually. This one's a little long, but I think worth it. As ordained ministers in a church whose rules of government and doctrine did not warrant the shedding of human blood, except it became necessary in defense of our families or ourselves, we felt it should be contemplated only as a last resort. In spite of this firm conviction, our spirits stirred deeply to the call of patriotic duty. We laid the matter before our fellow church members, and the question was discussed with much the same solemnity that doubtless characterized the Puritans, Quakers, Shakers, or other denominations whose tenets forbade the shedding of blood. I think it's fascinating that even this early, he's grouping us in that Peace Church community. Now, these are dictated probably 1920, earlier. Do we know when, Mark?
1905.
When is he dictating these memoirs?
Oh, it's about
1911. So this is probably a little later insight, but I still think interesting that he's putting us in that group. Prayers for guidance were fervently offered unto the Lord. When the answer came, it was clear, definite, and unmistakable. Do not enlist. Enlisting makes your military service an individual and voluntary action where you will be responsible for the blood you might shed while in service. Wait. If drafted, the responsibility is lifted. Do not shirk any duty the service requires, for through the conscription, the deed becomes a national sin instead of a personal one. Kind of an interesting position. I wonder, it'd be interesting if this is the beginnings of a just war position. I don't know. There are members in my congregation in Nauvoo, one member in particular, who desperately wanted to serve in World War II, and he was ready to go enlist, and his mom pulled out this statement from Joseph Smith III and said, "Nope, you can't do it." And he knew he couldn't. So he didn't. He went to the draft board and asked to be drafted. He was. He came home. Joseph Smith III on forgiveness. When Joseph was still a teenager, Emma was running a boarding house. The mansion house is a boarding house. On one occasion, she took exception to the relationship between a male and a female boarder, and she evicted them. And the man got mad and came back and pulled a gun on Emma. Joseph III nor Weideman were home at the time. Emma got really mad at that, and she threw them out. But Joseph III was really angry at this man who had pulled a gun on his mother, understandably so. But he thought, you know, I'm not of my majority. I can't do anything about it. But Lewis was gonna. When Lewis found out, he got a gun and he went after the guy. Not long after, Joseph III saw Lewis and the offender at a local bar having a drink together. So maybe that was one way to settle it, but not what Joseph III had in mind. The guy continued to live in Nauvoo, and Joseph III got angrier and angrier, and this anger grew into hatred. He hated this man. It was a malignancy eating away at him, and only made worse by later events in Nauvoo. But after Joseph III joined with the reorganization, he said, every time I said the Lord's Prayer, and I got to the forgiveness part, it would get me, it would poke at me. I knew that as long as I hated this man this way, I couldn't really say that prayer and mean it. So here's what he eventually set himself to overcoming that hatred. And he said, it took a long time, but I was able to do it. And he says, the experience taught me a lesson. It forced upon my mind the necessity for many of the teachings of the Savior. I had a clear understanding of what men were prone to feel of any unworthy nature than I could have obtained had I not had this experience and learned to know what it was to hate a fellow being. The knowledge helped to make me humble and to exercise sympathy and charity for others struggling under like feelings. Hatred is a cruel, destructive, and unlovely thing, and wholly unbecoming of a Christian. I think that's fascinating that it caused him to sympathize with people who were struggling with that because he himself experienced it. Emmeline Griswold passed away. She had given birth to 5 children, but she was not well, not healthy. She died, and very quickly, Bertha Madison, who was living in the Smith home, by that time in Plano, Illinois, to take care of the children and to help with Emmeline, Bertha Madison continues to live in the home. I think they even bring in a couple to chaperone, but church members soon start to gossip. There's an unwed woman living in the prophet's home, and you know, this is not appropriate, and they were making a pretty big deal about it. And he finally got so angry that he married her. Here's what he had to say. "Fault was particularly found with me because I did not wait the conventional year after the death of my first wife before taking my second. I had the extreme satisfaction of reminding them that the gossipers had not waited the conventional year before using malicious and too busy tongues upon my affairs, and that I was forced to marry in defense of both a good woman and myself." He, this is W.W. Blair, stated that another objection was that I had married a woman of foreign parentage. Bertha was Norwegian. "I simply told him that I had married my wife for myself and not for my neighbors or for the church, and that if I were satisfied, they had no reason to be otherwise. This seemed to settle the gossips." By 1877, conditions in Nauvoo had changed considerably. And I'm sure that a significant part of this is economic, but hundreds of Nauvoo citizens in 1877 signed a petition, you see one page of it here, inviting the reorganization to move their headquarters to Nauvoo. So think about that transition in 17 years from "you're not allowed to pray here" to "please move your headquarters here." So one of the pages of that petition, Joseph III on that: "It is difficult for me now, after the years which have gone by since that day, to give an adequate expression of my feelings at the time. I found my spirit swept with a wave of strong exultation. I confess to shedding some tears as I spoke, trying to express my appreciation." That was really, really meaningful to him, that change of heart among the locals. Joseph III on history. He had given at one point a copy of John C. Bennett's book on Nauvoo and the church to what is now, I think, the Chicago Historical Society. I think they just changed their name to the Chicago Museum. And some folks were stunned that he would give this, what they perceived as an anti-Mormon book, kind of is, to an institution to make it available to more readers. They couldn't believe he would do that. Here was Joseph III's response: "I know well enough that the book and others like it are in existence, and I would not suppress a single portion of any evidence for or against the movement. Let the whole story be told and every fact that can be found and proved brought to light. I am willing to let decisions be made upon that basis. I am not afraid of the truth, nor of a book like that," which of course he didn't consider the truth. Once again, Joseph III on forgiveness. You see here an image of Thomas Sharp, probably the most violently anti-Mormon person in Hancock County, Illinois. Sharp had published the Warsaw Signal and had called for the use of powder and ball to be finished with the Mormon problem. If there was any person who was singly most responsible for Joseph and Hiram's death, it's probably Thomas Sharp. Years later, Joseph III was in Carthage and he saw an old man in a wheelchair in the shade of the courthouse steps, And as Joseph III walked by this old man, he said, "Good morning." That was the extent of the conversation, "Good morning." But when some of our members found out about it, they were furious. How could you even speak to the man responsible for the death of your father? They said things like, "That won't do well with the old-time saints." Well, Joseph III reminded them that he was an old-time saint as well, And here was his response to our members who were angry that he had said good morning to Thomas Sherman. He said to them, we are, in an article entitled, "We Are Required to Forgive," he said in effect, "I forgive this man. If there's any judgment to be had, it'll be in the hereafter." He said, "We need to remember that our blessed Lord, our living exemplar, when suffering from the cruel pangs inflicted upon him to his death, lifted his eyes and heart to his father and said, 'Forgive them, for they know not what they do.'" And Joseph III made it clear in this article that he forgave Thomas Sharp. That sets the bar pretty high. Bertha Madison, Joseph III's second wife, was coming home one day to Liberty Hall, their home in Lamoni, Iowa by that time, and an itinerant merchant had stopped in the yard. He had his wagon in the yard, and Bertha's horse was spooked by this strange-looking wagon, took off. Bertha was thrown, and she was killed. Joseph III, late in life, remarried. He married Ada Clark, a Canadian. I'm not going to remember. He's at least in his late 60s by this time. And she's, what do we think, Mark? Late 20s?
Yeah, no more than 30.
Yeah, she's pretty young. Pretty young. Here's what Joseph III had to say about that marriage. "I have found in this last marriage an element of romance similar to that of my first. Few instances of married life under these conditions have been happier than mine. Seldom has a man in public life who has married a third time been more blessed in that later companionship than I have been." So he's having children into his late 60s and early 70s, three of whom ended up becoming presidents of the reorganization, the third of whom became our president 98 years after his father had. That's hard for me to comprehend, but Joseph III served as a prophet president for 54 years and then was followed by three of his sons, again the third of whom became our president 98 years after his father had. Most of what I've been sharing are the words of Joseph III. I'm going to finish with the words of others. Joseph III died in 1914 in Independence, Missouri. Is buried in Mountain Grove Cemetery. His is the larger stone. In front of it to the right is Frederick Madison Smith, one of his sons. Israel A. Smith, I think, is here as well. So a tribute from a local Kansas City newspaper, a non-Latter-day Saint paper. On Joseph III, he was the prophet, but first of all, he was the Christian gentleman and the good citizen. As such he lived, as such he died, as such he will be remembered by all outside the household of his faith. Kindly, cheerful, loyal to his own creed, tolerant of those of others, standing for modesty, simplicity, good citizenship, embodying in his private and public life all the virtues which adorn a character worthy of emulation. Such is the revelation which Joseph Smith leaves to the world. Questions?
Well, let me take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question. For someone interested in Joseph Smith III and the Community of Christ, what single volume, one volume, might you recommend in both instances for sort of, I hate to use the term the lay reader, but sure, for want of a better one, yeah, what would you suggest?
I'd suggest Roger Lanius's Pragmatic Prophet, University of Illinois title, incredibly well written. I'd start there. And then, if you get interested, Joseph Smith III's memoirs, which is the source for not everything I've shared, but much of it, has just been reprinted by Harold House. It is stunningly detailed. And there is wonderful detail, but some of it is mind-numbing detail. So you've got to do some sorting there, but amazing detail, including a lot of detail on his missions to Utah. It's kind of fun. He tracks down old friends from his childhood in Nauvoo once they've made it to Utah, and they reminisce about events in Nauvoo. He also has some great source material on his childhood in Nauvoo. the schools, you know, what do they do to play? You know, again, it's reminiscences, but he did keep journals, not as a child, but as an adult, and he seems to draw pretty heavily on some of those journals when he's dictating his memoirs. So that's fascinating material as well.
Is that a single volume or multi-volume?
The memoirs is a single volume, and then Pragmatic Prophet, a single volume.
And the history of the church itself, what would you recommend?
History of the reorganization. Mark, do you want to answer that one?
I can't.
Look, there's a
probably
great...
Dick Howard's two-volume work.
Dick Howard has a two-volume. Paul Edwards has a one-volume. Just as an introduction, there's a new illustrated history that just came out through Herald House. John Hamer, Barb Walden, David Hallett. John Hamer's involved. It's going to be beautiful. Beautifully illustrated. And it's just a really brief introduction to Community.
What do you know? I'm Polly Aird, and I'm Morlick, which is a Catholic interested in Mormon studies.
Never heard that term.
A very small, select group. I am descended from Mormon converts from Scotland who left the church in 1859 after all the troubles in the 1850s. On one side, and then my other side, they left the church in the early 1870s, and because they objected to Brigham Young, that being like a plutocrat, and the rest of the saints were living rather poorly. So my great-grandmother's sister eventually joined the reorganization in Nevada. She and her husband were sent there by the LDS Church for some reason. And I was wondering, and then my great-grandparents wrote themselves out of the LDS Church and were called by others Josephites. I don't know that they would ever join the RLDS. But I was wondering if there's any book that might give me kind of background on the early missionaries to the West that would include Nevada as well as Utah. It could give me some understanding of times and what the RLDS missionaries found and how people came. I've read some in the history of the church about the early two missionaries, but I didn't know if there was anything else.
I'm not sure I can send you a single source, but have you seen Ron Roebuck's stuff on Alexander Smith's early missions to the West?
No, I haven't.
I think, where was that just published? I think it's in a...
There's copies back here.
Is it an MHA journal?
Well, no.
His book on Alexander?
Right back in the exhibit area.
So there's two things to look at initially. John Whitmer Books has Ron Roeming's book on Alexander Smith, who was on many of those early missions to the West. And then I think in a Mormon history journal, wasn't that also... some form of that, focusing more on the Western missions, published recently, maybe in the last year.
Ron
Roeming. And then I look at the memoirs, which I didn't bring with me. I've got it. If I can grab it later, we can look at the index real quick and see Joseph III might bump into him. If I can get an email afterwards, I probably have some electronic sources that I can run some names for you, too.
Don't forget Valley Mabry's David Hiram Smith.
That'd be another really good one.
There's several chapters on the journeys that he took out west.
Comment was Valley Mabry's David Hiram Smith for Mission to Madness. Trying to catch up for the team.
Thank you.
I'm just a little confused on when Joseph III left Nauvoo and how long he lived there. Where he moved after. If you could just kind of summarize that.
Yeah, I can. Question, where did Joseph III live when? He had promised or vowed, I'm not quite sure which, to stay in Nauvoo for 5 years from the point at which he joined the reorganization. And I've seen conflicting accounts. Some seem to suggest it was because he was stubborn and angry about people trying to forbid him from practicing his religion there. So he's saying, in effect, you're not going to tell me what to do. I'm going to stay right here. And so I think he moves to Plano, Illinois, something like January 1st of 1866. Gets his 5 years in. But other accounts suggest that he had promised George Edmonds Jr., a non-member friend of the church, an attorney, that he would stay in Nauvoo and potentially consider it as a gathering place, and so that he was trying to fulfill that promise to Edmonds. But he stays in Nauvoo until 1866, moves to Plano, Illinois, and is there until the early 1880s when he goes to Lamoni, Iowa. And I think it's 1906 that he goes to Independence, Missouri. There is a brief exception, I think about 5 months in the winter of 46-47, Emma moves her family, which would include Joseph III, to Fulton, Illinois, right before the Battle of Nauvoo, the artillery battle that drove the last of the Latter-day Saints out of Nauvoo. So he was gone for 5 months, 46-47, but then back and there until 66.
Was Lamoni the headquarters?
The headquarters. Lamoni became the headquarters. It seems often hard for us to designate or to figure out where are the headquarters. So often we just decide that wherever Joseph III is where the headquarters are. But other times we say wherever Herald Publishing House is located is where the headquarters are. But Lamoni started as a really very carefully planned community. But Joseph III had lived through his father's efforts at gathered community in Kirtland and Missouri and Nauvoo with often disastrous consequences. So he was really cautious about calling everybody to move back together again. So they put together a joint stock company, and they very slowly and carefully began to develop what would become Lamoni. I'm not even sure that he was the driving force behind it. There were Methodists in that area first. Alma Blair tells me that they wanted a university or college. We weren't so sure, but eventually became convinced and created what is now Graceland University, but created it to be non-sectarian so that the Methodists in the area would feel like it was theirs as well. So he was really cautious about gathered community as a result of his father's experiences.
Locke, I really enjoyed the stories that you told, and many of them were new to me. I have heard a version of the story with Thomas Sharp, which probably is apocryphal, but I wanted to ask you, just to make sure, I had heard that Joseph Smith III actually went to his home and visited with him and told him he was forgiven. Is that not true?
I don't think, a question about a version of the Thomas Sharp story. I think, did you hear that from, do you know where you heard it?
Well, actually, I heard it during the time that I was taking Mark Shearer's class, history class, but it was not from Mark. So he is not the source of that story, but it was someone else in the class who was taking history and who told me the story. I was very impressed with it, of course. But now I'm hearing from you that the only thing you said to him was, good morning.
I think that's accurate. At least that's as far as I can tell. That
and there's no other source you know of?
Not that I know of. I think that a version of that has started to circulate, and I've heard it, the version you're telling. I think it's a misunderstanding of the earlier version. Is that your take, Mark?
Yes.
Can you go to the mic?
There is an account where Joseph III is really attacked verbally by this, and you're absolutely right. But there's the more, if you look further into what he says, Thomas Sharp at this time was a very broken man. Some would suggest he was in a wheelchair. And Joseph was chastising his critics by saying, anybody who would look at that man would feel the same as I. But you've got to feel sorry for the man. So forgiveness, yes, but also it's more than that. It's more compassion. Yeah. And that's very, very important because he was a very compassionate man, which dovetails nicely into the forgiveness.
I do think, and I need to track this source down, but that at one point, while others were attacking Joseph III in 1860 and shortly thereafter, after joining the reorganization, I need to find a source on that, but I do think that Thomas Sharp came out basically defending Joseph III's right to practice his religion.
That's right, he did.
And it says something like, and this, I'll paraphrase, it's his language, not mine, but something like, young Joe's not like old Joe.
That's right.
He doesn't have the militia and the et cetera. So as long as what he's doing is not threatening me, he has every right to practice his religion.
The one more point on this, Locke. Thomas Sharp didn't give what I would call a resounding on the ramparts support for Joseph Smith Jr., or the third, but by the very fact that he said, hey, Joseph is not the same as his old man, that spoke huge volumes to non-affiliated and people who were in the Nauvoo militia at Carthage and so on, or excuse me, the militia, the mob at Carthage. That was huge and really a statement of support.
Well, my suggestion is to go with a bigger, better story.
We've tried that.
Thanks for really an interesting presentation. This has been very nice. My question is, to what extent is Joseph Smith III's influence pervasive in the church today? I know that's a big question, but if you could respond to that.
Question about Joseph III's influence in the church today. I'd say it's not, but I'm young and give me some time. My sense is, and now I'm a little... I probably don't have the best perspective because I lived in Kirtland, Ohio for 15 years and now live in Nauvoo. And we have been very focused on Joseph Jr. and that portion of our history. Now, at times, the focus is not always positive, meaning that's what we're looking at, but we're pretty good these days at finding some of the difficulties. We're also looking again at the positives from that period. But because we just are celebrating the sesquicentennial of the reorganization. So April 6, 1860, Joseph III and Emma traveled to Amboy, Illinois, and united with the reorganization. We've been celebrating that this year, and that has given us an opportunity to rediscover much of this story that I think we've forgotten. That's why, for example, Susan is saying she hasn't heard a lot of these stories before, because they have not been a significant part of who we are. But I've been sharing versions of these stories over the last year, and people are incredibly excited about them and are really feeling a connection. So although I don't know that we're there yet, I think that as we continue lifting up some of these stories, they'll become pretty significant for us.
I'd like to make two comments. One, on the issue with Thomas Sharp, and this is by way of contrast. However Joseph, young Joseph may have handled this, let me contrast this with the LDS position. Until 1904, all members of the LDS Church who attended the LDS Temple were under a covenant before God, essentially to put Mr. Sharp to death. The fact that he lived out his life indicates that apparently there were no visitors from Utah who took their covenant seriously. But I'd like to point out that contrast. I'd also like to respectfully disagree with you as far as young Joseph's influence. I find this very significant. In the Book of Mormon, there is that position about opposition all things. There's been much discussion, I think this resulted in the change of the reorganization's name, is defining itself in opposition to the LDS Church. I believe the reorganization, Community Christ, has carried this out brilliantly, and I think that young Joseph's legacy of tolerance, which is throughout the reorganization, was specifically something he had to do. I think in following the injunction in the Book of Mormon, and there must be opposition to all things, he had to define himself. And I think many of his virtues, which carry down through the church today, including its sufficient faith in its history to question the history, is a brilliant legacy. I think his legacy permeates the whole reorganization, the Community of Christ, and I think this demonstrates it.
Very kind. And that's the part that Mark and I will be, and others, will be discussing and debating. How much of this is Joseph III's influence? I think you're right that there is more. We just don't recognize the source. We don't know where it's coming from. It's just kind of part of us now. So it'll be interesting to see if those connections are really, can we document those connections?
We have time for one more.
Whether or not we can document them, if you look at the 9 enduring principles that the Community of Christ adopted a year and a half ago, just in the quotes you shared today from Joseph Smith III, grace and generosity, the pursuit of peace, the blessings of community, unity and diversity, I could almost have paired those up in a column-by-column comparison. Now, Community of Christ wouldn't necessarily look to the words of the prophets from which to draw their doctrines and teachings. But I think the foundations were built very firmly by Joseph Smith III's approach to those and other ideas that you shared with us, that, like you just said, have made Community of Christ who they are today.
Thank you very much.
We did need to bring this session to a close, but I'm sure that Lachman would be glad to chat with you individually. I have one last burning question, however. Missouri, Missouri. Lamoni, Lamona. Where do you fall on that?
Bowie, Bowie.
Neither, neither. Potato.
Missouri, Missouri just depends on what town you grew up in.
Okay, what about Lamoni?
I think it's Lamoni.
I hear Lamona from time to time.
Yeah, I suppose if you grew up there, it's probably Lamona.
Yeah. Well, we'll sort it all out later. Thanks again. Let's give Lachman a round of applause.